This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott.
The first time it happened, I was 10. It was an accident. The second time I meant to last it out and not come back at all. I rocked shut as a seashell. They had to call and call and pick the worms off me like sticky pearls. Dying is an art, like everything else. I do it exceptionally well. I do it so it feels like hell. I do it so it feels real. I guess you could say I have a call.
Poet Sylvia Plath there reading Lady Lazarus from her then unpublished collection Ariel in October of 1962. This marks the 50th anniversary of Plath's death by suicide, the singular lens through which many readers and academics have viewed her life, her writing, and certainly her marriage. Now a new generation is rediscovering Plath from a fresh perspective, one not colored by her sad and almost macabre death. Liesl Schillinger is a New York-based arts writer, and she recently wrote about the 21st century resurrection and rebranding of Sylvia Plath. Liesl, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Well, thank you. Hello.
Well, hello. Sylvia Plath's collection, Ariel, was completed shortly before her death. That manuscript was then arranged, I believe, posthumously by Plath's estranged husband, Ted Hughes. Now, how important was that move? How important was his way of shaping the way she would be remembered?
Well, that is such an interesting question, and it's also really controversial, because I spoke to lots of poets who teach Plath and who care deeply about Plath. The trick is, Ted Hughes shaped the poetry collection so that it would seem to be grimmer, so it would seem to be ending up with the idea that this woman was bound for suicide. He did that by choosing which poems he included in it. And when their daughter, Frida, came out with the edited, restored version of that in, I think it was 2004, a few years after her father died, she put the poems back in the order her mother had arranged them in. And the world was stunned to see that the trajectory of that book, of that collection of poems, ended on an up note. I talked to a poet named Mark Wunderlich, and he teaches a course on Plath at Bennington. And as an example of how much Ted Hughes changed it, in his version, the last line of the book is, "Fixed stars govern a life." But in the Plath version, it ends, "They taste the spring." And so that's just an example of how careful selection determines how the book comes off and what we think of Plath.
So he was sort of stoking the despair.
That's what people say, but everyone has cautioned me not to say that he was a monster. And, you know, when you read the introduction to the Ariel poems that their daughter brought out, she does not blame her father. She says he was trying to make the best book of poems he could make, and he chose the way he chose. But obviously, she felt the need to correct the record because she painstakingly brought out the poem in the correct order and also showed her mother's manuscript in that book. So it mattered.
Well, Plath herself played a little bit of a role in emphasizing, I think you call it, the more negative aspects of self, you know, trimming away the positive. But she did apparently have this other life that we hear less about, that you write about, a love of fashion and of glamour. So this is coming to the surface now?
It's being brought to the surface in a new and really engaging way. A poet named Elizabeth Winder wrote a book called Pain Parties Work, in which she interviewed all of these women who knew Sylvia Plath when Plath was 20. These were 20 girls, we could call them that then, who had applied for an incredibly competitive internship at Mademoiselle magazine. They were all being put up at the ladylike Barbizon Hotel, and they were working really hard, but they were stylish, they wore conical bras, they wore girdles, they wore kitten heels, and they went on endless dates. And they were very much trying to be polished and socially successful as well as professional. And so was Plath. You know, if the people who are really deep into Plath are aware of her journals and they're aware of her letters home, and they know that she wrote in different tones depending who she was writing for. But she kept track of what she was wearing, how much things cost, and who she was seeing, what her dates were. And all of those come out in the book. And it kind of gives you a more whole portrait of Plath. Plath very much made us have a different and darker idea of that time. It was the summer of 1953, because that's where she starts in The Bell Jar, which is, you know, a really eerie autobiographical novel that she wrote that came out in England a month before she killed herself on February 11, 1963. So that book came out in England in January. In it, she describes her suicide attempt, which was long. Right after she finished that internship in Mademoiselle, she got depressed because she hadn't gotten into a very competitive writing class, and she felt worthless. And she took a bottle of pills and crawled under her mother's house and hid her way by pulling some logs in front of the hole, and she nearly died. Obviously, that ended up overshadowing her madcap days in New York that summer.
A lot of, you know, I would say college freshmen and, you know, sort of burgeoning goth movement sort of adopted Sylvia Plath as their own.
That's interesting. She's always appealed to introspective young women who are exploring the dark side of what young women want and don't get. But a thing that really interested me is that Megan O'Rourke, who's a young poet and writer, has written a lot about Plath, and she points out that Plath died just as second wave feminism was beginning. Mm. So she died at a time where people, Betty Friedan's Feminine Mystique came out that year, I believe, and people were starting to realize the frustration that women felt who had all this ambition, but who also wanted to fit into society and be wives and mothers, and society wouldn't let them be both things. You know, she was popular with rebellious women then, but what interests me in 2013 is that people are now saying, hold on, she's not just a suicidal, manic depressive. She's a woman writer who really deliberately crafted a voice in her poetry and had amazingly strong technique. And they want her to be pulled from this lurid biography into the real light of academic inquiry, just looking at her excellence and her gifts and learning from it.
Well, there is a resurgence among, certainly in the new media universe, a Sarah Louise Smith, she's a Londoner, who's now tweeting at It's Sylvia Plath, posting a couple of quotes of hers every day. What do you think is responsible for this kind of resurgence, this looking again at Sylvia Plath?
You know, one possibility is nobody has ever forgotten about Plath. And an interesting thing is she wasn't famous in her life. She was famous after her death. She became a mythic figure almost immediately because she clearly had suffered so much for her art. And, you know, every young woman, every young person thinks about the goal of suffering for your art. We understand that's kind of, that's noble. But some young woman figures now who are in the popular eye have influences from Plath that I guess we're all aware of, but subconsciously. An example is Lena Dunham has her television show Girls, in which women are talking about their OCD behaviors and about their depression and about their anger and about their sexual passions and frustrations. And Sylvia Plath was very early in writing so much about sexual energy and sexual tension. Her poems are indisputably dark, the ones that we remember most, like Daddy and Lazy Lazarus. She wrote a poem called Mad Girl's Love Song. That's one where she says, I shut my eyes and all the world drops dead. Mm. Well, I found out that mad didn't mean crazy, it meant angry. And she wrote that poem when she was mad because a boy was late for a date, you know. Some of the poems in Ariel are wild and scary, but some are beautiful. Some are about motherhood. This is not all just the ravings of a woman who's bent for the grave. These are poems that follow a trajectory that go from a dark winter to a spring that's full of hope.
But somehow that hope wasn't enough.
It wasn't enough. There's any number of arguments and disagreements about whether she meant to kill herself when she did that day. She was separated from her husband. She was angry. One thing that everyone from Lena Dunham to Sarah Louise Smith, the woman who has the Twitter feed, to Mark Wunderlich, the poet who teaches the Plath course at Bennington, was saying was that she would have had a different life today. We don't know what it would have been, but she would have had therapy. She would have had medication. She wouldn't have felt so alone. But as Megan O'Rourke said to me, well, girls today who feel the way Plath did have the bell jar to read. Plath didn't have the bell jar to read to find that she wasn't alone and to console herself.
Liesl Schillinger, New York-based arts writer, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Virginia.
I wish I had a Sylvia Plath busted tooth and a smile and cigarette ashes in her kind that goes out then sleeps for a week. The kind that goes out on her own to give me a reason for, well, I don't know. And maybe she'd take me to France, or maybe to Spain. She'd ask me to dance in a mansion on the top of a hill. She'd ash on the carpet and slip me a pill, and she'd get me pretty loaded on